Scales, I said. Would it be all right if I asked you a question, ma'am?
I welcome the question. I make no promises as to the answer.
I nodded. Who are you, really? Mother Summer stopped in her tracks and turned to look at me. Her eyebrows slowly lifted.
That is a very significant question.
I know, I said. Blame it on Halloween.
Why should I do that?
I shrugged and we began walking again.
It's just got me thinking.
Masks. I know of one figure from ancient tales who is alive and well and incognito. Why shouldn't there be more? Mother Summer inclined her head, more a gesture of acknowledgement or admission than agreement.
Things change,
she said.
Immortals deal poorly with change, but it comes to everyone.
I called Mother Winter by the names Atropos and Scald because they seem to fit her, I said. I mean, she likes her sharp implements, apparently. Mother Summer's smile appeared for a moment, dazzling me, and then was gone again.
It was not an imbecilic guess, she said. And yes, she has been known by such names before. But you've only guessed the name of one of her masks, not our most powerful name.
Our? I said. Wait, I'm confused.
I know,
she said.
Here we are.
We stopped in the middle of a forest path that didn't look any different from anything around it. Mother Summer stopped and frowned at me.
You really aren't dressed for the climate.
Don't worry about it, I said. I can handle cold. She let go of my arm, looked me up and down, then put a hand on the handle of the basket she carried over one arm and said,
Something a little less informal would be appropriate, I think.
I've played Ken doll to a fairy fashion advisor before, so I wasn't entirely shocked when my clothing began to writhe and simply change. When the Linanshi had done it, I'd sat in the car for half an hour, suffering through one fanciful and undignified outfit after another. Not this time. My clothes transformed from cloth into custom-fitted steel. Well, probably not steel, but whatever the equivalent was that the Shi used in their armor. The armor was plain and functional, with no ornaments on it. A breastplate, vambraces, and large pauldrons for my shoulders. Heavy tassets hung from the bottom of the breastplate, protecting my thighs. My lower legs were covered with greaves, front and back. The armor was black and gleaming, and where light fell directly on it, you could see shades of deep purple and dark blue. I realized that I was holding a helmet under my left arm, and I took it in both hands to look at it. It was a Corinthian helm, like they wore in that movie about the Spartans, only without the fancy tail. It was padded on the inside. I slipped it on, and it fit perfectly.
Much better, said Mother Summer. Stay near me at all times.
I looked around the perfectly serene forest. It was a bit of an effort, since the helmet kept me from turning my head very smoothly. I looked up, too.
I'm sure the armor made me look goofy.
Okay.
Mother Summer smiled, took my arm again, and stretched out one foot. She used it to brush a layer of dirt and fallen leaves from the pitted surface of a flat stone, like a paving stone, maybe 3 feet square. She tapped it 3 times with her foot, whispered a word, and drew me along with her as she stepped onto it. No drama ensued. The landscape simply changed. As swiftly and drastically as when you turn on a light while in a darkened room. One second we stood in an autumnal megaforest, the next? I've seen movies and newsreels about World War I. They didn't cover it as thoroughly in my schools, because America didn't have a leading role in it. And because the entire stupid, avoidable mess was a continental clusterfuck that killed millions and settled nothing but the teams for the next World War. But what they did show me, I remembered. Miles and miles of trenches. A smoke-haunted no-man's land strung with muddy, rusty barbed wire and lined with machine guns and marksmen. There was a pall of smoke that turned the sun into a dully glowing orb. But the movies couldn't cover all the senses. There was a constant rumble in the sky, thunder born of violence, and there was everywhere the smell of feces and death. We stood atop a small, barren mountain looking down. Near us, only a few hundred yards away, was an immense wall, the kind you'd use to hold out the Mongols if they were the size of King Kong. It was built entirely from ice or some kind of translucent crystal. Even from here, I could see that there were chambers and rooms in the wall, rooms containing barracks, hospitals, kitchens, you name it. There were dim and indistinct forms moving around in them. The walls were lined with what had to be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of soldiers. I peered, trying to get a better look, and then realized that they were armored Shi. All of them. They all wore armor similar to mine, its highlights throwing back the cool, muted shades of winter. Out beyond the wall was a land made of dust and mud and loose shale. It was covered in hillocks and steep gullies, and the only plants that grew there looked like they were certain to poke, scratch, or sting you. Though the land was somehow lit, the sky was as black as Cat Sith's conscience, without a single star or speck of light to be seen. And it was an overwhelming sky, enormous, like in the open rolling lands of Montana and Wyoming. There were more bodies of troops moving out there. Some of them looked like they might have been giants or maybe trolls. Larger groups containing smaller individuals were likely winter's gnomes. Things flew in the air. Bands of what appeared to be mounted cavalry rode back and forth. Some of the soldiers looked suspiciously like animated snowmen. From this vantage point, I could see two major engagements happening, each containing maybe 40,000 winter troops, and they were fighting. I couldn't make out the enemy. There didn't seem to be any unity of form. They were creatures. Creatures whose physiologies made no sense, were utterly without order. I saw what appeared to be tentacles, enormous mandibles, claws, fangs, club-like limbs and tails. They weren't bipedal. They weren't quadrupeds. In fact, they seemed to have no regard for bilateral symmetry at all. I peered a little closer and felt a sudden, horrible pressure inside my head. I felt dizzy for a second, nauseated, and at the same time, part of me was screaming that I needed to ditch my escort and go look at these things for myself, that there was something there, something I wanted to see, something I wanted to stare at for a while. A cold, somehow greasy tendril of energy slithered around inside my head, something I had felt before when I jerked my eyes away with a short grunt of effort, closed them, and left them closed. Holy! Outsiders? Mabs fighting outsiders? Mother Summer said nothing. I don't understand, I said finally. White Council intelligence always estimated Mabs' troop count at around 50,000. There are freaking formations out there with more troops in them than that. Mother Summer said nothing, but she did lift a finger and point off to the left. I looked and saw a pair of towers the size of the Chrysler building rising up over the wall. Between them was a pair of gates. The gates were something amazing to look at. They were huge, bigger than most Chicago apartment buildings. They were made of a darker shade of the same ice or crystal, and there were designs and sigils carved into them, layer after layer after layer. I recognized a couple of the ones I could see clearly. They were wards, protective enchantments. There was a sudden sound, a rising moan, like the wind shaking trees or surf striking a cliff wall, and the horizon outside the walls was suddenly lined with dark, grotesque figures, all of them charging forward toward the winter troops. Faint horn calls sounded, clear and valiant. Winter's troops began to retreat back toward the gates, gathering into a great arch on the ground outside them, locking their formation into place while cavalry harassed the oncoming outsiders, slowing their advance. Then the cavalry streaked from their engagement, passing safely through the lines of infantry to come riding back through the gates. The outsiders came on and crashed against the winter lines. Battle ensued. From this far away, it just looked like a big, confusing mess, with everyone jostling for a better position, but I could see a few things. I saw an ogre go down when an outsider spit acid that started eating through his eyes into his skull. I saw the winter lines falter, and the outsiders began pouring reinforcements into the weakness. Then a small crew of goblins exploded out of a pile of shale at precisely the right moment, when the outsiders were pressed almost into the winter lines, but before reinforcements arrived. The surprise attack drove the outsiders forward, when I could see that the weak regiment had been playing the outsiders for suckers, falling back, but doing so in good order. The outsiders had overreached themselves, and were now surrounded on all four sides by the savage troops of winter. The would-be invaders didn't make it. And that was only a tiny fraction of the battle. My senses and mind alike simply could not process everything I was seeing. But my heart was beating very swiftly, and frozen fear had touched my spine like Mab's fingers. The outsiders wanted in. "When?" I asked. "When did this start?"
"Oh, Harry,"
Mother Summer said gently. "What?" I asked. But I had noticed something. Those layers and mounds of shale? They weren't shale. They were bones. Millions and millions and millions of fuck-tons of bones. "What the hell is going on here?" I breathed. "Where are we?"
"The edge of Faerie," she said. "Our outer borders. It would have taken you a decade to learn to travel out this far."
"Oh," I said. And it's like this?"
"In essence,"
Mother Summer said. She stared sadly out over the plain.
"Did you think that Mab spent all her days sitting in her chair and dealing with her backstabbing courtiers? No, Sir Knight. Power has purpose."
"What happens if they get in?" I asked. Mother Summer's lips thinned.
"Everything stops. Everything."
"Holy crap," I breathed. "Does Summer have a place like this too, then?" Mother Summer shook her head.
"That was never its task. Your council's estimate was fairly close, counting only those troops protecting the hearts of winter and summer. Mab has more than that. She needs them. For this."
I felt like I'd been hit repeatedly in the head with a rubber hammer. "So, Mab's troops outnumber yours by a jillion."
"Indeed."
"So she could run over you at any time."
"She could," Mother Summer said, "if she were willing to forfeit reality."
I scanned the length of the wall nervously. It looked like it went on forever, and there was fighting all along its length. "You're telling me that this is why Mab has her power? To protect the borders?"
"To protect all of you from the outsiders, mortal."
"Then why does Titania have hers?" I asked.
"To protect all of you from Mab."
I swallowed.
"Titania cannot match Mab's forces, but she can drag Mab personally into oblivion with her, and Mab knows it. Titania is the check to her power, the balance."
"If Mab dies," I began. She swept a hand along the length of the wall.
"A spoiled, sadistic, murderous, and inexperienced child will have control of all of that."
Hell's bells. I rubbed at my eyes, and as I did, I connected some dots and realized something else. "This is a siege," I said. "Those guys out there are attacking the walls. But there are others trying to dig their way in so that they can open the gates for their buddies. That's what the adversary is, right? A sapper, an infiltrator." Mother Summer said,
"There, you see. You possess the potential to be quite intelligent. Do stay beside me, dear."
And she started walking firmly toward the massive gates. It didn't take us long to get there, but as we drew up to the base of the wall and walked along it, we started drawing the eyes of the wall's defenders. I felt myself growing tenser as a marching column of armored Shi soldiers came stepping lightly along the ground behind us, catching up quickly. Mother Summer guided me slightly aside so that we weren't in the column's way, and they started going by us. I didn't think much of it until someone at the front of the column called out in a clear voice, and as one, the Shi came to a halt with a solid, simultaneous stomp of a couple of hundred boots. The voice barked another command, and the Shi all turned to face us. "Uh-oh," I said. Mother Summer touched my hand with hers, and reassurance bathed me like June sunshine. "Shh." The voice barked another command, and as one, the Shi lowered themselves to one knee and bowed their heads.
"Good morrow, cousins,"
Mother Summer said, her voice solemn. She took her hand off my arm and passed it in a broad, sweeping arch over the kneeling soldiers. Subtle, subtle power thrummed delicately in the air.
"Go forth with my blessing."
One of the soldiers in the lead of the column rose and bowed to her, somehow conveying gratitude. Then he snapped out another loud command, and the column rose, turned, and continued its quick-step march. "Huh," I said.
"Yes?"
asked Mother Summer. "I was sort of expecting something else."
"Winter and summer are two opposing forces of our world," she said. "But we are of our world. Here, that is all that matters, and showing respect to one's elders is never unwise."
"Yes, ma'am," I said. Mother Summer gave me a small, shrewd smile. We continued our walk in their wake and soon reached the gates. There I saw a smaller set of gates, sally ports, built into the main gates. They were the size of the garage doors on a fire station. As I watched, someone shouted a command, and a pair of heavily armored ogres each grabbed one of the sally ports and drew it open. The column that had passed us stood waiting to march out, but they did not immediately proceed. Instead, a column of carts and litters entered, bearing the groaning wounded of the fighting outside, being watched over by several dozen Shi dressed in pure white armor, marked with bold green and scarlet trim, Shi Knights of Summer, medics. Despite the massive numbers of troops I'd seen moving around, there were fewer than 100 casualties brought back to the gates. Evidently, the outsiders were not in the business of leaving enemies alive behind them. A lean figure came down a stairway built within the walls framing the gates. At first, a shadowy blur through the layers and layers of crystal. He was a couple of inches taller than me, which put him at the next best thing to 7 feet, but he moved with a brisk, bustling sense of energy and purpose. He wore a dark robe that looked black at first, but as he emerged into the light, highlights showed it to be a deep purple. He carried a long, pale wizard staff in one weathered hand, and his hood covered up most of his face, except for part of an aquiline nose and a long chin covered in a grizzled beard. He spoke to the summer and winter Shi alike in a language I didn't understand, but they evidently did, giving instructions to summer's medics. They took his orders with a kind of rigid, formal deference. He leaned over to scan each of the fallen closely, nodding at the medics after each, and they would immediately carry the wounded Shi in question back behind the wall into what looked like a neat triage area.
"Rashid," I murmured, recognizing the man.
"What is he doing here?" I froze and stared up at the massive gates rising above us. Rashid, a member of the Senior Council of the White Council of Wizards, had another title, the name he went by most often. The Gatekeeper. He finished with the last of the wounded, then turned and approached us with long, purposeful steps. He paused a few steps away and bowed to Mother Summer, who returned the gesture with a deep, formal nod of her head. Then he came the rest of the way to me, and I could see the gleam of a dark eye inside his hood. His smile was wide and warm, and he extended his hand to me. I took it and shook it, feeling a little overwhelmed.
"Well, well," he said.
His voice was a deep, warm thing, marked with an accent that sounded vaguely British, seasoned with plenty of more exotic spices.
"I had hoped we would see your face again, Warden."
"Rashid," I replied.
We're They're... The gatekeeper's smile turned a bit rueful. Ah, yes, he said. They're impressive the first time, I suppose. Welcome, Warden Dresden, to the outer gates.
Chapter 34
The outer gates aren't real, I said numbly. They're supposed to be a metaphor.
Mother Summer smiled very faintly.
I'll leave mortal business to mortals, she said. I'll be nearby, young wizard.
I said, thank you. She nodded and walked away toward the wounded she.
Well, the gatekeeper said to me.
He seemed, if not precisely cheerful, it was something that lived on the same block, positive, confident, and strong.
You've managed to travel a very long way from home.
Mother Summer drove, I said.
Ah, he said. Still, I can't recall the last time a wizard of your age managed the trip, however it was done. You take after your mother.
I blinked. You knew her?
Those of us who spend any amount of time walking the ways tend to develop a certain amount of camaraderie. We would have dinner every so often, compare notes of our walks, and there were several of us who were friends of Ebenezer who took it upon ourselves to watch over her.
I nodded, keeping my face as blank as I could. It was not general knowledge that Maggie Le Fay had been Ebenezer's daughter. If Rashid knew, it was because my grandfather trusted him. The fresh armored column of she began to move out, and as they did, horns began to call in the land beyond. Rashid turned his head toward them, listening as if to a spoken language, and the smile faded from his mouth.
They're massing again, he said. I have little time.
He reached up and did something I'd seen him do only once before. The gatekeeper lowered his hood. He had short hair that was still thick and gleamed silver, but his features were weathered as if from long years under harsh sunlight. His skin was paler now, but there was still something of the desert on his skin. His face was long, his brows still dark and full. He had a double scar on his left eyebrow and cheek, two long lines that went straight down, a lot like mine, only deeper and thicker, and all the way to his jawline. And they were much softer with long years of healing. Maybe he hadn't been as good at flinching as I was, because he'd lost the eye beneath the scar. One of his eyes was nearly black, it was so dark. The other had been replaced with... I looked around me. Yes, definitely. The other eye had been replaced with the crystalline material that was identical to that which had been used to create the gates and the walls around them. Steel, I said.
Pardon, he asked. Your, other eye. It was steel before. I'm sure it looked like steel, he said. The disguise is necessary when I'm not here.
Your job is so secret your false eye gets a disguise? I asked.
Guess I see why you miss council meetings.
He inclined his head and ruffled his fingers through must-tousled hood hair.
It can be quiet for years here, sometimes, and others, he spread his hands. But they need a good eye here, to be sure that the things that must remain outside do not slip in unnoticed.
Inside the wounded, I guessed, or returning troops or medics.
You've become aware of the adversary, he said, his tone one of firm approval. Excellent. I was certain your particular pursuits would get you killed, long before you got a chance to learn.
How can I help? I asked him. He leaned his head back, and then a slow smile reasserted itself on his face.
I know something of the responsibilities you've chosen to take up, he said. To say nothing of the problems you've created for yourself that you haven't found out about yet. And still, in the face of learning that our world spins out its days under siege,
you offer to help me?
I think you and I could be friends.
Wait, I said. What problems? I haven't been trying to create problems.
Oh, he said, waving a hand. You've danced about in the shadows at the edge of life now, young man. That's no small thing, to go into those shadows and come back again. You've no idea the kind of attention you've attracted.
Oh, I said, good.
because the pace was starting to slow down so much that I was getting bored. At that, Rashid tilted his head back and laughed. Would you be offended if I called you Harry? No, because it's my name. Exactly, he said. Harry, I know you have questions. I can field a very few before I go. I nodded, thinking. Okay, I said. First, how do you know if the adversary has, infested someone? Experience, he said. Decades of it. The sight can help, but... Rashid hesitated. I recognized it instantly, the hiccup in one's thoughts when one stumbled over a truly hideous memory gained with the sight, like I'd had with... the Negloshi. I don't recommend making a regular practice of it. It's an art, not a skill, and it takes time. Time, or a bit of questionable attention from the fates, and a ridiculously enormous tool. He tapped a finger against his false eye. I blinked, even though he didn't, and looked up at the massive gates stretching overhead. Hell's bells, the gates. They're some kind of spiritual cat scanner? Among many other things, he said. But it's one of their functions, yes. Mostly it means that the adversary cannot use such tactics effectively here. As long as the gatekeeper is vigilant, it rarely tries. The horns sounded again, and the muscles in his jaw tensed. Next question. I hate trying to be smart under time pressure. This, I said, pointing up at the gates. What the hell? How long has this attack been going on? Always, he said. There are always outsiders trying to tear their way in. There are always forces in place to stop them. In our age, it is the task of winter to defend these boundaries, with the help of certain others to support them. Think of them as an immune system for the mortal world. I felt my eyes get wide. An immune system? What happens if it, you know, if it breaks down for a bit? Pardon? The gatekeeper asked. It gets a glitch. Like if somebody new took over or something and things had to reorganize around here. Most years it would pose no major difficulty, he said. What about this year? This year, he said, it could be problematic. Problematic? Rather severely so. Rashid studied my face and then started to nod. I see. There are things happening back in winter. That's why Mother Summer brought you here, to show you what was at stake. I swallowed and nodded. No pressure or anything. Rashid's face reacted at that, though I couldn't say what the exact mix of emotion on it was, though one of them was a peculiar kind of empathy. He set his staff aside and gripped my upper arms with his hands. Listen to me, because this is important. Okay, I said. You get used to it, he said. I blinked. What, that's it? He tilted his head to look at me obliquely with his good eye. I'll get used to it? That's the important pep talk? I'll get used to it? His mouth quivered. He gave my arms a last, maybe affectionate squeeze and released them. Pep? What is needed in the warden is far more than pep, Harry. What, then? I asked. He took up his staff and poked my chest with it gently. You, it would seem. You, he repeated firmly. What we need is you. You have what you have for a reason. Unwitting or not, virtually your every action in the past few years has resulted in a series of well-placed thumbs in the adversary's eye. You want to know how you can help me, Harry? I said, frustrated. Yeah. Go back to Chicago, he said, turning away, and keep being yourself. Wait, I said, I need help. At that he paused. He looked back at me and gave me a quiet smile. I know precisely how it feels to be where you are. He gestured back toward the battleground. Precisely. He seemed to think about it for a moment and then nodded. I will do what I can. If we both survive the next several hours, I will settle matters between you and the Council, which knows only as much about our roles as it needs to, and that isn't much. I will verify your return, and that you are indeed yourself, and will see to it that your back pay as one of the wardens is forwarded to you. There's some paperwork to fill out to get the council's office to re-establish your official identity with the government, but I'll see to it that it happens. I think I remember all the necessary forms. I stared at him for a second and said, You'll help me with White Council paperwork?
He held up a finger. Do not underestimate the depth of this favor, he said soberly, but his eye was twinkling. And on a similar note, do not underestimate yourself. You haven't been given the power and the knowledge and allies and the resources you possess for no reason, Harry. Nothing I have to say can possibly make this task any easier for you. The only way to do it is to do it. He lifted his chin. You don't need help, Warden. You are the help.
We're in trouble, I said.
He winked at me, restored his hood to its usual position, and said,
We always are. The only difference is, now you know it. God be with you, my friend. I will cover this in. You see to yours.
He took several rapid paces out from under the towering gates and gestured. A second later, I kid you not, a freaking woven carpet, maybe 10 feet by 20, came sailing neatly down out of the sky, coming to hover about 6 inches off the ground beside him. Rashid stepped onto the carpet, slipped his boots into some kind of securing straps on it, and then lifted his staff. The carpet and the gatekeeper rose serenely up out of sight, and a second later went streaking out over the storm-lit battlefield in a howl of whirling winds. And that's when it hit me. I mean, when it really, really hit me. It was up to me. There wasn't a backup plan. There wasn't a second option. There wasn't any cavalry coming over the hill. The White Council was the next best thing to clueless about what was happening, and would never in a zillion years admit that they were. Tonight, a catastrophe that could kill millions of people, including my daughter, was going to happen unless I stopped it. And on top of that, there was a deadly turbulence happening inside the Winter Court, and depending on which side I threw in on, I could save or destroy the world as we knew it. Walking away from this one was not an option. No dodges, no delays, no excuses. It would happen or it wouldn't, depending on me. I looked down at my bruised hands. I slowly closed them into fists and then opened them again. They were battered hands, and they didn't have anywhere near as much skill as I could have wished were in them, but they were what I had. I had earned the scars on them. They were mine. I'd done this before. Never on this scale, maybe, but I'd done it before. I'd saved the day, mostly, more or less, on several occasions. I'd done it before, and I could do it again. There wasn't any other way it was going to happen. The only good thing about having your back to the wall is that it makes it really easy to choose which way you're going to go. I felt like throwing up. But I stiffened my back and straightened my shoulders and walked quickly over to Mother Summer as she finished standing up from tending to the last of the wounded she.
Ma'am, I said quietly, I'd appreciate it if you could take me home. I have work to do.
Chapter 35. With all the benevolence she'd had going on, I sort of forgot that Mother Summer wasn't human. She took me from the gates back to her cottage in silence, smiled, touched my head with her hand, and sent me back to my freaking grave. I landed on my ass in the muddy, broken ice, and could still hear the echoes of the crackling detonation when Mother Winter's ugly mitt had smashed up through it and grabbed my noggin. I could still hear the raucous cawing of startled crows. Time had all but stopped while I was gone. Or more accurately, time had flown by extremely swiftly where I had been in the Never Never relative to Chicago.
I'd been on the other side of that kind of time dilation while dealing with beings of fairy before, but this was the first time I'd actually benefited from it, gaining time rather than losing it, which I hadn't even considered until now. If things had gone the way they usually did when one got pulled into fairy business, I could have been gone for an hour and come back a year later, to what would presumably have been a blasted wasteland. The thought made my stomach churn with anxiety. But I suppose I hadn't exactly volunteered for the trip. It wasn't like I'd taken a hideous risk on that score. It had been something entirely outside of my control. That was scary, too. While I was sitting there, wondering whether that meant that I was a control freak or just sane, a goth kid poked her head into view atop my grave and peered down at me. She took a cigarette in one of those long holders out of her mouth, exhaled smoke through her nose, and said,
"Dude, that is pretty hardcore down there. Are you, like, gonna cut yourself or something?"
"No," I said, self-consciously hiding my hand behind my back. I looked down, and only then did I realize that my outfit had changed from the she armor back to the second-hand clothes I'd been wearing before. I fell. Other gothlings appeared. The girl repeated herself, and the others agreed that I was hardcore down there. I sighed. I gathered my things and clambered out with some reluctantly offered help. I didn't need it, but I thought it might be good for some kid's self-esteem. Then I looked around at all the people staring at me, hunched my shoulders up around my head, and hurried out of the graveyard before anyone else could become helpful. When I got back to Molly's place, she asked, "Why do you smell like cloves?" "Kids today," I said. "I'm just glad they weren't smoking marijuana." She said, "Goths. So I guess that's grave dirt on you?" "Stop Sherlocking me," I said. "And yes, it is. And I'm showering. Any word?"
"Not yet," Molly said. "Toot's waiting outside for his crew to get back. I had to promise him extra pizza to keep him from going out to look himself. I figured we needed him to coordinate the guard."
"Good thinking," I said. "One sec." I went into my temporary quarters and got clean. It wasn't just because I had mud from a century-old graveyard on me, along with an open wound on my hand, and because I feared about a million horrible things that could be made from those ingredients. The whole wizard metabolism thing means that our immune systems are pretty much top of the line. I doubted the Winter Knight's mantle was slouchy in defending against such mundane threats either. It was mostly because I'd been up close and personal with some extremely powerful creatures, and such beings radiate magic like body heat. It's the sort of thing that can cling to you if you aren't careful, maybe coloring the way you think a bit, and definitely having the potential to influence anything you do with magic. It happens with people, too, but with people, even wizards, their aura is so much less powerful that the effect is negligible. Running water cleanses away the residue of that kind of contact, and I wanted to be sure that whatever happened tonight, I wasn't going to be handicapped by any mystic baggage from today's visits. I hit the shower, bowing my head under the hot water, and thought about things. The mothers had been trying to tell me something, something they hadn't said outright. Maybe they hadn't wanted to just give me what I wanted, but way more likely, maybe they were incapable of it. I had bullied Maeve and Lily into straight talk, such as it had been, and it had obviously been uncomfortable for them. I would never have tried the same thing on Titania or Mab. For whatever reason, it seemed that the essential nature of the Queens of Faerie was to be as indirect and oblique about things as possible. It was built into them, along with things like not being able to tell a direct lie. It was who they were. And the farther up the chain you went, the more steeped in that essential nature the queens became. Maybe Titania or Mab could be a little bit straightforward at times, but I doubt they could have laid out a simple declarative statement about the issue at hand without a major effort. And if that was true, then maybe the mothers couldn't have done it even if they wanted to. There'd been a message in all their talk, especially Mother Summers. But what the hell had it been?
Or maybe this wasn't a human fairy translation problem at all. Maybe this was a male-female translation problem. I read an article once that said that when women have a conversation, they're communicating on 5 levels. They follow the conversation that they're actually having, the conversation that is specifically being avoided, the tone being applied to the overt conversation, the buried conversation that is being covered only in subtext, and finally, the other person's body language. That is, on many levels, astounding to me. I mean, that's like having a freaking superpower. When I, and most other people with a Y chromosome, have a conversation, we're having a conversation. Singular. We're paying attention to what's being said, considering that, and replying to it. All these other conversations that have apparently been going on for the last several thousand years, I didn't even know that they existed until I read that stupid article, and I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. I felt somewhat skeptical about the article's grounding. There were probably a lot of women who didn't communicate on multiple wavelengths at once. There were probably men who could handle that many just fine. I just wasn't one of them. So, ladies, if you ever have some conversation with your boyfriend or husband or brother or male friend, and you are telling him something perfectly obvious and he comes away from it utterly clueless, I know it's tempting to think to yourself, the man can't possibly be that stupid. But yes. Yes, he can. Our innate strengths just aren't the same. We are the mighty hunters who are good at focusing on one thing at a time. For crying out loud, we have to turn down the radio in the car if we suspect we're lost and need to figure out how to get where we're going. That's how impaired we are. I'm telling you, we have only the one conversation. Maybe some kind of relationship veteran like Michael Carpenter can do too, but that's pushing the envelope. 5 simultaneous conversations? 5? Shoo, that just isn't going to happen. At least not for me. So, maybe it was something perfectly obvious and I was just too dumb to get it. Maybe the advice of someone less impaired than me would help. I went back into my head and made sure that I remembered the details of my recent conversations, putting them in order so that I could get a consult. Once my brain had resolved that, it went straight down a road I'd been trying to detour around. If I blew it tonight, people I loved were going to die. People who weren't involved in the fight. People like Michael and his family and my daughter, Maggie. Should I call them? Tell them to hit the road and start driving? Did I have the right to do that when so many other people's loved ones were at risk too, with no possible way to get them out of reach of harm? Did that matter? Was I going to be responsible for my daughter's death, the way I was for her mother's? The lights didn't waver, but it got really, really dark in that shower for a minute. And then I shook it off. I didn't have time to waste moaning about my poor daughter and my poor life, and gosh, do I feel bad about the horrible things I've done. I could indulge my self-pity after I'd taken care of business. Scratch that, after I'd taken care of business. I slammed the water off hard enough to make it clack, got out of the shower, dried, and started getting dressed in a fresh set of second-hand clothes.
"Why do you wear those?"
asked Lacuna. I jumped, stumbled, and shouted half of a word to a spell, but since I was only halfway done putting on my underwear, I mostly just fell on my naked ass. "Gah!" I said. "Don't do that!" My miniature captive came to the edge of the dresser and peered down at me.
"Don't ask questions."
"Don't come in here all quiet and spooky and scare me like that."
"You're 6 times my height and 50 times my weight,"
Lacuna said gravely.
"And I've agreed to be your captive. You don't have any reason to be afraid."
"Not afraid," I snapped back. "Startled. It isn't wise to startle a wizard."
"Why not?"
"Because of what could happen."
"Because they might fall down on the floor?"
"No," I snarled. Lacuna frowned and said,
"You aren't very good at answering questions."
I started shoving myself into my clothes. I'm starting to agree with you.
So, why do you wear those?
I blinked. Clothes?
Yes. You don't need them unless it's cold or raining.
You're wearing clothes.
I am wearing armor for when it's raining arrows. Your t-shirt will not stop arrows.
No, it won't, I sighed. Lacuna peered at my t-shirt.
Aerosmith! Aerosmith, does the shirt belong to your weapon dealer?
No.
Then why do you wear the shirt of someone else's weapon dealer?
That was frustrating in so many ways that I could avoid a stroke only by refusing to engage. Lacuna, I said, humans wear clothes. It's one of the things we do. And as long as you're in my service, I expect you to do it as well.
Why?
Because if you don't, I might pull your arms out of your sockets. At that, she frowned.
Why?
Because I have to maintain discipline, don't I?
True,
she said gravely.
But I have no clothes.
I counted to 10 mentally. I'll find something for you. Until then, no desocketing, just wear the armor, fair enough? Lacuna bowed slightly at the waist.
I understand, my lord.
Good, I sighed. I flicked a comb through my wet hair, for all the good it would do, and said, How do I look?
Mostly human,
she said. That's what I was going for.
You have a visitor, my lord.
I frowned. What?
That is why I came in here. You have a visitor waiting for you.
I stood up exasperated. Why didn't you say so? Lacuna looked confused.
I did. Just now. You were there.
She frowned thoughtfully.
Perhaps you have brain damage.
It would not shock me in the least, I said.
Would you like me to cut open your skull and check, my lord?
She asked. Someone that short should not be that disturbing. No, but thank you for the offer.
It is my duty to serve,
Lacuna intoned. My life, hell's bells. I beckoned Lacuna to follow me, mostly so I would know where the hell she was, and went back out into the main room. Sarissa was there. She sat at the kitchen table, her small hands clutched around one of Molly's mugs, and she looked like hell. There was a dark red mouse on her left cheekbone, one that was swelling and beginning to purple nicely. Her hands and forearms were scraped and bruised, defensive injuries. She wore a pale blue t-shirt and dark blue cotton pajama pants. Both were soaked from the rain and clinging in a fashion that made me want to stare. Her dark hair was askew and her eyes were absolutely haunted. They darted nervously toward me when I appeared and her shoulders hunched slightly. Molly said something quiet to her and rose from the table, crossing the room to me. She said you knew her, Molly said. I do. She all right? She's a mess, Molly said. Showed up and begged security to call me before they called the cops. And it isn't the first time this has happened to her. She's terrified to be here, terrified of you personally, I think. I frowned at my apprentice. Molly shrugged. Her emotions are really loud. I'm not even trying to pick anything up. Okay, I said. Is she on the level? I thought about it for a second before I answered. She's Mab's BFF. So that would be a no, then, Molly said. Probably so, I said. There's bound to be an angle here, even if she doesn't know that there is one. She's a pawn in Winter. Somebody has got to be moving her. Molly winced. She's also a lifelong survivor in Winter, so don't let your guard down. The last creature who did wound up as frozen kibble. I jerked my head toward the exit. Heard anything from the scouts yet? She shook her head. Okay, we'll talk to her. Stay close. I might need to pick your brain about something later. Right, Molly said, blinking a little. Then she followed me back over to Sarissa. Sarissa gave me a nervous smile, and her fingers resettled on the mug a couple of times. Harry? I didn't realize you made house calls all the way to Chicago, I said. I wish it were that, she said. I nodded. How did you know where to find me?
I was given directions, she said.
By who? She swallowed and looked down at the tabletop.
The Red Cap.
I sat back slowly in my seat. Maybe you better tell me what happened.
He came for me, she said quietly without meeting my eyes. He came this morning. I was hooded, bound, and taken somewhere. I don't know where. I was there for several hours. Then he came back, took my hood off, and sent me here, with this.
She reached down to her lap and put a plain white envelope on the table. She pushed it toward me. I took it. It wasn't sealed. I opened it, frowned, and then turned it upside down over the table. Several tufts of hair bound with small bits of string fell out, along with a small metal object. Molly drew in a sharp breath.
He said to tell you that he's taken your friends, Sarissa said quietly.
I picked up the tufts of hair one at a time. Wiry black, slightly crinkled hairs, sprinkled with silver ones. Butters. Red hairs, luscious and curly. Andy. And a long, soft, slightly wavy lock of pure white hair. I lifted it to my nose and sniffed. Strawberries. I let out a soft curse.
Who? Molly asked, her voice worried.
Justine, I said.
Oh, God.
I picked up the metal object. It was a plain bottle cap, slightly dented where it had been removed. And Mac, I said quietly. He had someone following me everywhere I went. He took someone from each place.
He told me to tell you, Sarissa said, that he'll trade them all for you, if you surrender to him before sundown.
And if I don't, I asked.
He'll give their bones to the Rawhead, she whispered.
Chapter 36 Silence fell.
Okay, I said into it. I've just about had enough of that clown.
Molly looked up at me, her eyes worried.
You sure?
Guy gets his jollies dipping his hat in people's blood, I said.
You can bargain with the she sometimes, Molly said.
But not this time, I said, my voice hard.
If we do, he'll keep the letter of his word and he'll make sure they don't make it out anyway. The only way we're getting our friends back is to take them away from him.
Molly grimaced, but after a moment she nodded.
I picked up the clumps of hair and put them in a neat row on the table.
Molly?
On it, she said, collecting them. What are you doing?
Sarissa asked, her eyes wide.
The jerk was kind enough to give me some fresh cuttings from my friends, I said. I'm going to use them to track him down and thwart him.
Thwart? Sarissa asked.
Thwart, I said. To prevent someone from accomplishing something by means of visiting gratuitous violence upon his smarmy person.
I'm pretty sure that isn't the definition, Sarissa said.
It is today. I raised my voice. Cat Sith, I need your assistance, please.
Sarissa went completely still when I spoke, like a rabbit who has sensed a nearby predator. Her eyes widened, then flicked around the room, seeking escape.
It's okay, I told her. I'm getting along with him.
You're a wizard and the Winter Knight, Sarissa hissed. You have no idea how vicious that creature is, and I don't have the Queen's Aegis protecting me.
You have mine, I said. I raised my voice, annoyed. Cat Sith! Kitty, 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 kitty!
Are you insane?
Sarissa hissed.
He might not be able to get through, Harry, Molly said. It's not just a threshold here. The Svartalves have wards over the building as well.
Makes sense, I said. Be right back. I went out and looked around, but Sith didn't appear. I called his name a third time, which, as we all know, is the charm. With beings of the Never-Never, it's a literal truth. I mean, it's not an irresistible force like gravity. It's more like a kind of obsessive-compulsive disorder that happens to be present to varying degrees in most of them. They respond strongly to things that happen in threes, be they requests, insults, or commands. So in a way, three really is a magic number. Hell, just ask Menage Thomas. Jerk.
I waited for a while, even going so far as to turn about and take a few steps backward before turning forward again, just to give Sith some really rich opportunities to appear abruptly and startle me. Except he didn't. I got a slow, squirmy feeling in the pit of my stomach. The rain was still falling in spits and showers, but the clouds had begun to gain the tint of a slow autumn sundown. Sith had always appeared almost instantly before. Had Mab been setting me up? Had she given me the eldest Malk's assistance so that she could pull the rug out from under me when I needed Sith the most? Had she gotten the Nemesis brain mold? I hadn't seen Sith since the confrontation at the Gardens. Had the enemy she brought him down? Or worse, the adversary? I felt actively sick to my stomach. If Cat Sith had been turned, there was no telling how much damage he might cause, especially to me. I felt a little stupid about the kitty, kitty, kitty thing. Hopefully he hadn't been listening. I went back into the apartment, pensive. Molly gave me an inquiring look. I shook my head. Molly frowned at that. I could see the gears whirling in her brain. Okay, I said. Plan B. Lacuna, come here, if you please. After a moment, a little voice said from the direction of my room,
What if I don't, please?
You come here anyway, I stated. It's a human thing. She made a disgusted noise and came zipping out of the room on her blurring wings.
What do you want me to do?
You can read, I said. Can you read a map, right?
Yes.
You're on house duty then, I said. If any of the little folk come back with a location where a rite is taking place, I want you to write down their descriptions and mark the location on the map. Can you do that? Lacuna looked dubiously at the maps spread out on the table.
I think so. Probably. Maybe.
And no fighting or duels.
What about when I'm done writing things?
No. Lacuna folded her little arms and scowled at me. Your breath smells like celery, I replied. Molly, how are those spells coming along? I think there's some kind of counterspell hiding them, she said. It's tricky, so stop bumping my elbow. I'm concentrating over here. I let out an impatient breath and fought against a surge of anger. She was the apprentice, and I was the wizard. There were wizards who would have beaten unconscious any apprentice who spoke to them like that. I'd always been kind to her, maybe too kind. And this disrespect was what I got in return? I should educate her to respect her betters. I made a low, growling sound in my chest and clenched my fists. That impulse wasn't mine. It was Winter's. Molly and I had a relationship built on structure, trust, and respect, not fear. We had always bantered back and forth like that. But something in me wanted to, I don't know, put her in her place. Take out my frustrations on her. Show her which of us was the strongest. And it had a really primitive idea of how to make that happen. But that was unthinkable. That was the mantle talking. Loudly. Hell's bells. As if I didn't have enough trouble thinking my way past the influence of my own glands already. I heard a slight sound behind me and turned in time to see Sarissa vanish into the bathroom, moving in absolute silence. The rabbit had given up the statue routine and bolted. Sarissa had good instincts when it came to predators. I turned back to Molly to find her looking at me, her eyes wide. Molly was a psychic sensitive. She could feel emotions the way most of us can feel the temperature of a room. Sometimes she could even pluck someone's thoughts out of the air. She knew exactly what I was feeling. She had all along. And she hadn't run. Are you okay? She asked quietly. It's nothing, I said. I forced myself to think my way past the mantle's influence. Find a steel needle to use as the focus, I said. Should give you an edge against whatever magic the she are using. Should have thought of that, Molly chided herself. That's why they pay me the big bucks. I turned and walked away from my apprentice to let her work without the distraction of my tangle of Winter's urges blaring into her skull like an air horn.
I rummaged around in her fridge and made a sandwich from a bagel I split down the middle and a small mountain of two different colored deli meats. I wolfed it down. Less than 5 minutes later, Molly tied a needle onto a piece of wood with